The U.S. city on track to be hardest hit by COVID-19, a dire warning from one of the nation's top infectious disease experts. We're talking to him today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. We need to proceed to red alert, so says Dr. Peter Hotez of Baylor College of Medicine, who warns face masks may not be enough to prevent the Houston region from rivaling what we're seeing now in Brazil. Also, a downturn like no other, what job losses in the oil industry could tell us about the future of the Texas economy, and a broader forecast from Texas economist Angelos Angelou, and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this Wednesday, the 24th day of June, 2020. I'm David Brown. Hope your day has been a good one so far. I was thinking about the conversations we were having in Texas 3 months ago when the lives of so many Texans were upended by stay-at-home orders, mandatory face masks, and other measures aimed at flattening the curve. You know, back then there was a whole lot of talk about whether officials had struck the right balance between public health and economic survival. Fast forward to this week, and businesses across Texas find themselves on the front lines of enforcing face mask restrictions. Some business owners now calling on Governor Abbott to order Texans to wear face masks in public. But that may not be enough. There's now a real danger that our biggest and most diverse city is on a fast track to becoming the hardest hit city in the U.S., according to one of the nation's top infectious disease experts. Dr. Peter Hotez is professor and dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine. Dr. Hotez, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to talk about a tweet that shook up a lot of people. You sent this out over the weekend, and I quote, "My observations, if this trajectory persists, Houston would become the worst affected city in the U.S., maybe rival what we're seeing now in Brazil." What leads you to that conclusion?
Well, let's remember the strategy behind that. It's obviously a very provocative statement. In this case, it was actually deliberately provocative. You know, if you've ever heard me on TV or radio, I tend to talk too much like an academic. You know how academics talk. We use a lot of shades of gray and nuance. But every now and then, you need to show a flash of anger or emotion in order to move the needle. Texas, we're still bickering about whether or not to wear face masks. And I'm like, really? We should have had that, you know, 2 weeks ago. I mean, look at the trajectory this morning. If we continue along that trajectory, we will definitely be like a city in Brazil, and we will be the worst affected city in the country.
Well, then let me ask this. You state that the masks are a good first step, but simply won't be enough.
Right now,
there are a lot of calls for the governor to institute mandatory use of face masks. If that's not good enough, what is? What would be good enough, in your opinion?
Well, here's the problem. The numbers are rising so steeply now in our metro areas, in Houston, in Dallas, in Austin, San Antonio, that I think for our metro areas, the masks are going to be important, but they won't be adequate. I don't see how the numbers start going down just with masks alone, and we're going to have to take additional steps and some level of re-implementing social distancing. What I don't have for you, the answers are, what exactly do we do? How aggressive is it? And does it look like what we did back in March or just some component of that? But we've got to do more than just simply put on face masks.
Well, Dr. Hotez, the governor says he's listening to health experts. If he were listening to you, what steps should he take given the trends that you're looking at?
Well, first of all, he's got to look at some of the epidemiologic models. And I know some of these models have been criticized. But, you know, when you look at the ones coming out of the policy labs at the University of Pennsylvania, they look absolutely apocalyptic and actually worse than some of the Brazilian cities. And so take a look at that and say, you know, what's the goal in terms of preventing ICU admissions? And I think that's going to be some type of stay-at-home mandate for the workplace, for restaurants, for bars, for gyms. And, you know, I don't want to speak for the governor, but he's got to do some component of that. And he has to do it by this week. He can't wait till next week because every passing day, it gets harder and harder to put this thing back in the bottle.
I was looking at the latest COVID-19 hospitalization numbers, and we've crossed that 4,000 threshold already. But I've also been hearing the official numbers on hospital capacity. And as I understand it, as of yesterday, there were still some 14,000 available beds. So is there a concern? How serious the concern about overwhelming our ability to deal with the rising number of cases?
The greatest hospital capacity right now is in Houston because of our amazing Texas Medical Center where I work. We have different estimates between 2,600 and 2,800 ICU beds. So that's mammoth, right? And right now we're at half capacity. But at this trajectory, we fill up in 2 weeks. Remember, it's not like you're going to get a lot of notice. That's going to go up a little and a little bit more and a little bit more after that. It doesn't go in a linear curve. It goes in what's called an exponential curve where it stays flat for quite a bit of time. And this builds an extra complacency and people are like, hey, let's go to bars, let's go out to the beach. But then you see a very steep exponential, almost vertical acceleration. And that's what we're seeing, unfortunately. So now we're on the vertical phase of that, and that's very tough to contain. And so we need pretty dramatic measures now to bring that down.
I want to shift gears momentarily here, Doctor. Yesterday at a congressional hearing on the Trump administration's response to the pandemic, Dr. Anthony Fauci of the NIH, National Institutes of Health, said he was cautiously optimistic that a COVID-19 vaccine will be available in late 2020 or early 2021. That's an if, not when situation. Do you share his optimism?
Well, I partly share his optimism. I'm pretty confident we will have multiple COVID-19 vaccines ultimately available, maybe including our vaccine that we're accelerating now at Baylor College of Medicine and Texas Children's Hospital. But I don't see a path by which we're going to have it at the time frame he's talking about. We're just going to begin phase 3 trials for the first vaccine, the Moderna vaccine, next month. Then the others will follow throughout the fall. It's going to take a year and doing a 30,000 person study to collect enough information to show that those vaccines work and are safe. And so the earliest that I see is around Q3 2021. And even that would be a world and speed record. I'm not even sure we can make that. But if all the stars align, I think we can do it. I don't see a scenario by which we're going to be out there by January of next year.
Dr. Peter Hotez is professor of pediatrics and dean for the National School of Tropical Medicine, Baylor College of Medicine. Dr. Hotez, thanks again for your time.
Oh, thanks so much.
Let's stay in Houston if we can. In many cities across the country, local governments are using emergency orders to protect renters from being evicted, but not in H-Town. There have been a statewide ban on evictions, but it expired, and the Texas Supreme Court has refused to reinstate it. So in Greater Houston, that's put administrative judges in the spotlight, making determinations on whether landlords can kick out renters behind in their payments. Houston Public Media's Jen Rice has more.
When a landlord puts up an eviction notice, many renters leave immediately. But when they don't, the case goes before a justice of the peace. They're called JPs.
No, under the Texas Supreme Court, we have leeway in how we give our dockets, and we're using that leeway, taking everything in consideration, social distancing or whatnot.
That's Jeremy Brown. He's one of 16 of these judges elected in Harris County. While Brown's an attorney himself, that's not a requirement for the job. In fact, one JP is a former Rockets player, and now it's all eyes on them as to what happens next with evictions.
The folks in whose hands this now lies are the justices of the peace. So they have full discretion and authority to postpone.
A couple weeks ago, Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo and Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner sent a letter to all the JPs in Harris County. They asked them to come together and formally postpone evictions until the end of August. Hidalgo said she'd do it herself if she could, but she doesn't have the authority.
I'm hoping that each of the 16 judges commits to doing this, and we were very intentional about writing to each of them individually so folks can see which have committed to do this for the community and which have not.
Like other judges in Texas, justices of the peace defer to the Texas Supreme Court. But the Harris County Attorney's Office says the court gave them the power to issue an order delaying proceedings during the pandemic. Houston Public Media asked all 16 JPs in Harris County, how are you responding to Hidalgo's letter? Only two answered. Judge Jeremy Brown said he doesn't want to use a broad brush to determine cases.
If we push off certain dockets, we are delaying the inevitable.
Another JP told us he deferred to the Supreme Court's order that evictions may continue. Judge David Petronella said in an email the court could have frozen proceedings but didn't. It's not just county officials like Hidalgo hoping to influence these elected judges. We dug into their campaign finance reports. We found most of their campaign donors are landlords, lawyers, and the Houston Apartment Association, which represents landlords. In fact, that group donates to 15 out of 16 current judges. So, do justices of the peace have the power to issue an order and delay evictions? We checked in with 5 different experts. The overwhelming answer was yes. In fact, JPs in Austin took that step last week. Nick Wirch is an attorney with the Workers' Defense Project.
They do have the authority, and the question is whether they're going to use that authority to keep people in their homes.
Heather Way, a law professor at the University of Texas at Austin, agreed.
So that order seems to give courts a lot of discretion in terms of how they're going to operate.
But Howard Bookstaff, the attorney for the Houston Apartment Association, told me it's not just a matter of having the authority.
The court has given them authority to suspend rules, but only if it's for a COVID-19 transmission reason.
Like other agencies, JP courts don't want to spread the coronavirus, so some judges have held eviction hearings over Zoom. But housing advocates say transmission of the disease isn't the only issue. They argue housing is a human right and people can't pay rent if they've lost their job.
It's heartbreaking all the time, but particularly right now.
Adam Pirtle is an attorney with the group Texas Housers.
One case last week, you know, a daughter was having to translate for her father who was COVID-19 positive, wasn't able to find work, and I don't know what's going to happen to those people.
Harris County has seen 7,000 eviction filings since March, and analysts say that's a vast undercount since many people never make it to court. They pack up and leave as soon as they get an eviction notice. I'm Jen Rice in Houston.
Eric Austin, managing editor over at KERA North Texas, joining us to monitor the talk of Texas, in for Wells Dunbar. Hello there, Eric.
Hey, David. Managing the Twitters this morning, and Texans are sounding off about the 2020 presidential race. A new national poll out this morning showing Joe Biden is ahead of President Trump by 14 points. The poll by the New York Times shows the former vice president has 50% and the president has 36%. And boy, are Texans talking about this. Texas Shamrock 665 says this is not the time to get too comfortable. Remember that Hillary Clinton was leading in polls by 20% 4 years ago. Robert Smart says this poll means nothing. The state's ground game does, and you have to overcome massive voter suppression. Mama Earth Angry on Twitter is still angry about Bernie Sanders not getting the Democratic nomination. She's saying hashtag Green Party 2020. And Peggy says the only poll that matters is on Election Day in November.
Hey, Texas, let's hear from you. You know what to do. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Eric Austin, back in 35 with more of the Talk of Texas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The National Trust for Historic Preservation has reversed course and joined anti-racism protesters across the country in a call to remove monuments to the Confederacy. In the last couple of weeks, many local governments have agreed to do that in cities around Texas. KERA's Miranda Suarez caught up with a man who's been campaigning for years to remove a monument that's been in Denton's town square since 1918.
The statue of a young man stands with a rifle, facing south, on top of a white stone arch with the words, "Our Confederate Soldiers." When Denton County Judge Andy Eads announced the county would seek permission to move the monument, he said it was to protect it from vandalism and called the decision a matter of public safety. That didn't sit right with Willie Hudspeth.
He didn't mention me at all. Now, I might have had just a little bit to do with that.
Hudspeth moved to Denton in 1970 after fighting in the Vietnam War and has been deeply involved in civic life. He's best known for his campaign against the monument, which he started in the late 1990s. He spent countless Sunday evenings protesting in the town square. And like many who want to see monuments like Denton's come down, he questions why it was there to begin with.
And the word O-U-R is on it. Our Confederate Soldiers. So who is our? It most certainly needed black people. They were trying to get rid of us or keep us in slavery.
Hudspeth's opinion on what should be done with the statue has changed over the years. Now he wants to see it preserved but moved, which is what the county has agreed to do.
Now we're starting a new journey, which is I'm going to tell him where that thing should go.
Demonstrations over the killing of George Floyd have brought down similar monuments across the South. Protesters are tearing them down, or local governments are deciding to get rid of them. Tarrant County commissioners voted to remove a Confederate monument in front of the county courthouse the same day Denton did. Dinah Ramey Berry is a history professor at UT Austin who says some Confederate monuments were put up decades after the Civil War. In fact, the one in Fort Worth was erected in 1953.
African Americans are not able to go into particular buildings. They're limited in public spaces. They have to use a different ticket window to go to the theater and amusement parks. And at this same time, these statues were being put up to celebrate the Confederacy.
Berry says some of the modern push to take down Confederate symbols started with the massacre of 9 black churchgoers in Charleston, South Carolina in 2015. An activist famously climbed the flagpole outside the South Carolina State House and took down the Confederate flag that flew there. Many Confederate monuments were also removed after a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, 2 years later.
A lot of these statues have been taken down in moments where we see the ramifications of race relations, the ramifications of Jim Crow era segregation, the ramifications of police brutality today.
Willie Hudspeth says Denton County's vote to remove the Confederate monument in the town square is a great first step. And he's glad that throughout this journey, he kept an open mind while staying focused on his goal.
Growing up, trying to figure it all out, that's what kept me going, that rebel without a cause. And so I just carried, naturally carried, right over into what I'm doing now, just issues. And I've learned how to talk about them and bring them up. I know how to do it.
Hudspeth says he'll return to the town square with new missions, like fighting sex trafficking. And he's also getting some recognition for his work over the last 20 years. The mayor of Denton has designated the day the commission voted to remove the monument as Willie Hudspeth Day. I'm Miranda Suarez in Denton.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Terminal decline, the words a London-based think tank called Carbon Tracker chose to characterize the state of the oil industry at present. The rise of green energy paired with the coronavirus pandemic has hobbled a market already prone to boom and bust cycles, and as the sector endures another crash. Some workers, particularly young workers, headed into the industry are rethinking their careers. Sergio Chapa spoke to some of them. He reports on energy for the Houston Chronicle. Sergio, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Hey, Dave. Glad to be here.
You open your story with one young man, Troy Hild. What was he facing when you spoke with him?
Well, Troy, you know, he went to college and, you know, it was always his dream to get a job in oil and gas. He studied engineering and he watched his classmates drop out of school and get like high paying six-figure salary jobs in the oil fields. That was during the 2014-2015 bust. A lot of those kids, his classmates, came back to school when they got laid off. But guess what? They paid for all their classes in cash. And so that really stuck with him. So he wanted the same for himself, and he got degrees in civil engineering, mechanical engineering, and it paid off finally. You know, after college, he got a couple jobs, construction companies, but finally got his big break in the oil and gas industry. But then the coronavirus happened and the price war between Russia and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And oil prices went to negative and he found himself laid off in April.
Probably with a lot of school debt left, too. Another, Santiago Huerta. He took a different path. He left a job for renewable energy. Compare and contrast. What led him to working on a wind farm?
So Santiago comes from a small town called Raymondville. That's down in the Rio Grande Valley. You know, high levels of poverty down there. He watched his older brother and other friends in town get jobs in the Eagle Ford Shale. High-paying jobs, $90,000 a year in a town where most people make, you know, $24,000 a year. And he got an entry-level job in the oil fields, but he didn't find the overtime or the bonuses that his brother got. Instead, he was getting paid $13 an hour at drilling sites and hydraulic fracturing sites. So he got out of the business also and went to wind energy. And as it turns out, a lot of the mechanical skills he learned in the oil fields transferred.
I want to ask you about whether or not you sense that there's something different about this particular downturn in carbon-based energy that's different. We see boom and bust cycles all the time, jobs come and go, right? But is there any reason to think that this one's going to be different from previous ones?
The one thing that makes it stand out from, you know, the previous bust and other busts is how fast it happened. You know, according to figures from the Texas Workforce Commission, the oil and gas industry shed something about on the scale of 27,000 jobs in a single month, and that was April. And that rapidity of job loss has never been seen in the industry, and it's something to reckon with. And when that happens, you know, the youngest workers and the oldest workers in the industries feel the pressure. And then it's also a barrier to entry to the industry for college students and recent college graduates.
What kind of long-term effect do you predict that this exodus is going to have on the oil sector workforce should the market actually recover? Or do you think it's going to be back to business as usual or no?
Well, yes. I mean, that's one of the problems that workforce development experts are trying to grapple with right now in the industry as well is, you know, does this industry look attractive to new workers and those what they got laid off, do they want to come back? For a lot of them, you know, they've been through these busts before. And the fear is that some of these workers are just going to tap out. You know, they've had enough. And with the older workers, they're feeling pressure to take these buyouts, these retirement packages. And what you see happening is a bubble being created of workers age 40 to 55, you know, staying in the industry. And you're not getting that new generation of workers.
Sergio Chapa reports on the oil and gas industry for the Houston Chronicle. We'll link to his latest over at texasstandard.org. Sergio, thanks for the update.
No problem. Anytime.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, helping patients fight cancer with telemedicine. Virtual online appointments are available for patients to continue their cancer journey while practicing safe social distancing. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The white gunman accused of killing 22 people during a mass shooting targeting Mexicans at an El Paso Walmart last August is facing a 23rd murder charge. El Paso County District Attorney Jaime Esparza plans to file the additional count Thursday for a victim who died 9 months after the attack that also wounded dozens of others. State prosecutors have charged the suspect with capital murder. He's also facing federal charges, including multiple hate crimes, and remains jailed while awaiting trial. The American Civil Liberties Union of Texas is seeking the release of nearly 140 people at the LaSalle County Regional Detention Center near Laredo. Federal officers are holding them to serve as material witnesses in immigration-related criminal proceedings. The ACLU filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of six plaintiffs who have been detained for at least 3 months. The group says their rights are being violated because the government continues to hold them without critical individual findings or hearings. Attorney David Donati says one petitioner, Mercy Rocio Ducci Vargas, was arrested in January to testify against two women who smuggled her into the U.S.
And the defendants in that case, the people who actually are accused of doing anything wrong, they were released on bond back in February. But Mercy can't be released on bond because she can't pay $25,000 cash. And so she's just been incarcerated ever since.
Donati says detention has become too normalized in the U.S.
So this is a broader issue that we have where we rely on our prisons so much that we don't take into account what it feels like for a human being to be deprived of their liberty for 3 months, 4 months, 5 months. We think that's normal or these people deserve it.
Donati adds all six plaintiffs are concerned about being detained during the pandemic because they're living in close quarters without access to hand sanitizer and face mask. The number of homes for sale in Texas is bouncing back after a month of unprecedented declines. Economist Luis Torres from Texas A&M's Real Estate Center says new listings in May grew more than 23% compared to April when they shrank by 24%.
And the big picture is that people are going out and trying to list their house for sale. even with the bad numbers, we're still having the economy. We're starting to see people say, you know what, the economy opened up, I want to sell my house, I want to move.
Meanwhile, home sales in Texas last month fell to their lowest level since 2012, but at a slower pace than in April when statewide COVID-19 restrictions shut down most non-essential activities. Torres says more housing on the market is a sign home sales are likely to increase this month. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
It's the Texas Standard. In the past, we've often heard economists tout the diversification of the Texas economy as a sign that during economic downturns, the state will be more resilient, able to recover perhaps faster than other states. But we're looking at a downturn that Texas has never before seen. With COVID-19 and after, what is the new economic reality likely to look like for Texas? We've been speaking with top economists about this question, and Angelos Angelou has studied the Texas economy for decades. He is the founder of Angelou Economics, an economic research firm in the Texas capital city. Mr. Angelou, thanks so much for joining us on the Texas Standard.
You're quite welcome.
Something that I think a lot of people have been discussing is just how deep the economic impact might be. What is your take on whether or not it's too early to make a full estimate?
Well, much of the data regarding COVID-19 is coming in with 1 week to 2 weeks lag time. Much of the federal data regarding employment and unemployment has about a month or so lag time. Mm-hmm. The retail sector has about 2 months lag time. So it's really hard to predict what the future is going to be just based on a few weeks worth of data. Nevertheless, the data at this point in time is not looking good, but it's looking better than in April.
What do you see as the net impact on Texas's ability to meet its basic needs? I'm talking about from a state level.
Well, I'm forecasting about a 1.2 million job loss for Texas for 2020. Now, some of that is going to be regained, hopefully, in the third and fourth quarters of this year. The state's oil and gas extraction industries have been devastated from lower prices. That trend will stay about the same. The damage has already been done. We should expect to have a new normal there. As far as COVID-19 is concerned, you know, businesses can be open, but we cannot really legislate consumer confidence. So we're going to be looking at the new normal, lower spending, more savings. Much of the state's revenue is dependent on sales tax revenue. Those numbers have not looked very good in the last few months. Local and state governments are going to be challenged to provide services. So I think a couple of things need to happen there, both cost cutting, it will have to occur, as well as borrowing more money. There's no way out. We will see the levels of debt that we've never seen before, whether it's at the local or state or national level. However, you preface this program by saying we always recover from every economic downturn, and we will. We will emerge stronger than ever before. I mean, that's the nature of our economy, that's the nature of our people.
But as you're aware, Mr. Angelou, you know, Texas has long been touted by its officials trying to sell the virtues of the Lone Star State as an exceptional place. In the short term versus long term, how do you see that playing out? Is Texas going to remain exceptional on the U.S. map?
Absolutely. This has been a great business climate that has been cultivated for years vis-a-vis other states. Texas is doing extremely well. And when the economic recovery occurs, if you will, more people from other states will come to Texas looking for employment.
How do you see it? If opportunities are still low or at levels comparable to other places, why would someone go to the expense of trying to move out of state and come to Texas? What would be the attraction?
Because simply, this economic downturn is not limited to Texas. And other places a lot worse than Texas. Look at what is happening in New York and New Jersey and in California and Washington State. So what I'm simply implying is that as the economy gets back to near normal levels, the number of jobs available in Texas will be greater than in other states.
No doubt you've heard that Tesla has purchased a large tract of land southeast of Austin. What do you make of that? Is it a blip, or is it significant in your reading?
Well, no, I think this is a very significant project. This is going to be the third auto manufacturing facility in Texas. I hope that they start building their factory quick, because 5,000 jobs and 4,000 or 5,000 jobs from suppliers, it's a good shot in the arm.
Angelo Sangelu is founder of Angelo Economics, an economic research firm based in the Texas capital. Thanks so much for joining us on the Texas Standard.
You're quite welcome.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town with downtown shopping, Gulf seafood, and family attractions such as Moody Gardens, the Bryan Museum, and more. Details at galveston.com.
Hello, my name is Johan Ramirez. I am a general manager for Caliber Collision. It started pretty weird because all of a sudden there was no cars on the road. And even though we don't want anybody having accidents, we still like to stay busy. And we make a living out of fixing cars. Collision repair is still considered an essential business. So we were able to keep the doors open, but there was no work to do. The way technicians get paid is called the flag hour. So basically you get paid by the job. And it was a little scary, but they basically tightened up the belt and they said, we're not gonna let anybody go. Basically the CEO and the president came out on a video and they just said, we're not getting paid until this is over. And they guaranteed the technicians not quite 100% of what they are used to making on a weekly basis, but a big majority of it. Gosh, we took that time to clean the shop and paint and pressure wash. I mean, all sorts of things that are not in the job description. I had a lot of teammates that are hourly teammates, and we had to shorten the hours of operation. Even though the hours were cut, they would still want to work. And you know, I was like, hey, you can't be here off the clock, you know? And they were like, I'm not working. I'm just hanging out with my teammates, you know? And yeah, they were cleaning and just taking care of the shop, taking care of each other. You know, when you realize that it comes all the way from the top, that your top executives are, you know, out there paying the price for all of us, then everybody's thankful and does the same thing. So all of a sudden turn from a job where you're worried about your pay to what can I do so my teammates are okay. My name is Johan Ramirez, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
It's Texas Standard time. I'm David Brown. For rural West Texas, the threat of COVID-19 has seemed as something that would come to the area from the outside, you know, from visitors coming from cities harder hit by the virus. That's why early on, West Texas officials shuttered hotels and short-term rentals and enacted ordinances that limited residents and visitors from coming and going. Those early measures seemed to have an impact. For months, cases in remote parts of Texas were few. But now numbers are beginning to add up. As of today, there are nearly 70 in Brewster and Presidio counties. This, as more and more places in far west Texas have opened up, like Big Bend National Park, where Marfa Public Radio's Carlos Morales reports.
Just outside of Santa Elena Canyon in Big Bend National Park, I meet two visitors.
Matt Martin Lightfoot.
Katie Martin Lightfoot.
Visiting from Austin.
They say the whole drive over, they thought about what their presence might mean for a region that at that point had yet to be hit hard by the coronavirus.
We were talking about on the drive over here of bringing our, like, quote-unquote big city germs, like, into a more remote area.
The two are here during the first week of the park's reopening, and they say after a few months of working from home and little social interaction, they just needed a break. I mean, that's why I'm here. I've been feeling cooped up in Marfa and needed to get out, too.
This is probably the closest I've been to someone, actually, since we've been out here. No, you're fine. But, I mean, we brought our face masks with us, our hand sanitizers. So, like, the whole social distancing thing is definitely still something that we are very cautious of and doing.
And when you're here, Bob Krumenacker is strongly encouraging you to do all of those things. He's the superintendent at Big Bend National Park, and he says he's been agonizing over how to safely reopen the park, one of the region's largest draws for tourism. When we talk at a distance, he's wearing a mask, so he sounds a bit muffled.
There's no clear right and wrong here. In a lot of people's economic lives and most of all their health lives will be affected by the decision I make.
By Krumenacker's estimate, the park is further from medical care than any other national park in the lower 48. Even in normal times, he says getting medical help in the remote park is a challenge, but the pandemic has complicated it further.
4 hours of transport, however much time they have to be at the hospital, however much time it took to get to the patient and package them, and then when they're all back, they have to decontaminate everything.
For the entire 800,000-acre park, there's just one ambulance, and not many more across the region, too. And the hospital in Alpine the area relies on? 25 beds, 2 ICU beds, a handful of ventilators, and 0 medical specialists.
Yeah, this has probably been the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my entire career.
Across the Big Bend region, others are also grappling with reopening. For nearly 2 months, counties in far west Texas ordered hotels and Airbnbs to close. But they've been taking reservations again now for a while.
It's been stressful. It really has. I mean, being closed was stressful. How long is this going to last? What's going to happen to my staff?
Vicky Barge is the manager at the Hotel Paisano in Marfa.
And then reopening, same thing. How easy is this going to be? And again, what's going to happen to my staff?
Businesses across the region have focused their messaging on getting tourists to understand the local healthcare landscape. You'll see signs and social media posts that say, small town, no hospital, please wear a mask. For Barge, it's been difficult to manage the health and safety of her team while interacting with so many visitors.
I personally have heart disease. My partner that I live with has a compromised respiratory system. You know, I have a 9-month-old grandson. But I'm thinking, okay, I don't want to put them in jeopardy.
What Barge doesn't know, though, is in just a few days after we talk, new cases in the Big Bend region will be announced. They're vastly community spread, being traced back to businesses, a school district, and a state park. Alpine City Manager Eric Zimmer says there are still residents who just haven't taken the pandemic seriously.
Now, with new cases in the community, you've got this other group that was kind of along the sidelines wondering, is it going to hit us? So absolutely a heightened sense of concern.
As confirmed cases continue to climb, the impact of the coronavirus is now becoming less abstract. Dr. Ekta Escobar is the head of the region's COVID-19 task force. She says people should still stay home if possible and wear masks in public and continue to stay 6 feet apart in order to slow the spread of the virus.
This is not the place to get sick. This is not the place where we want a lot of our community getting sick with COVID, because our limited healthcare system won't be able to handle a large influx of patient volume locally.
From the outside, the Big Bend region seems like the perfect place to be during a pandemic. The towns are spread out and sparsely populated too. But that feeling of safety hinges on there being few COVID-19 cases here. If the disease continues to spread and strains the region's one hospital, then the area can quickly become one of the scariest places to be. I'm Carlos Morales in Marfa.
Think people are drinking more alcohol these days? Apparently not. Bloomberg News reporting that U.S. alcohol sales have actually fallen since the start of the pandemic. While people are buying more booze from grocery stores, that hasn't offset the drop-off in sales to bars and restaurants. We've got a PolitiFact check of the governor coming up just around the corner. And we are fast approaching 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. During a press conference last week, Governor Greg Abbott said this about coronavirus in Texas.
Fewer Texans test positive for COVID-19 than residents of any large state in the United States. We have the second lowest death rate of the 25 most affected states in America. Only about 10% or even less of Texans who test positive for COVID-19 ever even need to go to the hospital in the first place.
Now, are those statements true? Here to help us find the facts, Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas, which is based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, good to speak with you again.
Good to speak with you, too.
There's a lot to unpack in this quote. Maybe we should, what do you think, break them down one by one?
I think that's the best way to do it. We looked at each claim and we gave them each a rating on the Truth-O-Meter.
All right. Well, that sounds like a way to go. Let's look at the first claim. Fewer Texans test positive for COVID-19 than residents of any large state in the United States. I wonder what a large state is defined as, according to Governor Abbott.
I had the same question when I heard him make this statement, and he didn't offer any specifics, and his office didn't return a request for comment from me here, so I decided to look at this a couple different ways. So what I decided to do was look at the only three states in America with a population of more than 20 million people, which is California, Texas, and Florida. Of those states, Florida reported the fewest raw count of positive coronavirus cases, with more than 77,000 positive test results to Texas's 89,000. And then California was up higher. They had more than 151,000 positive tests. But you know that we can't just talk about raw numbers here. So I also looked at the positivity rate of these states, which is the percentage of the tests they've administered that have come back positive. Right. And both California and Florida reported a lower positivity rate than Texas. But since we don't know exactly what Abbott was talking about here when he said large state, I also looked at the top 10 most populous states to expand the scope a bit. And in that pool, Texas is far from being the state with the fewest positive test results. It's actually reported the fourth highest number of positive tests.
I see. So a ruling here.
We rated this claim false.
False. All right. Well, let's go to the next claim. We have the second lowest death rate of the 25 most affected states in America. How did you go about trying to evaluate that one?
So again, it's not clear which states Abbott considers to be the most affected by the coronavirus. So I looked at this a couple different ways as well. I first looked at the 25 states that have reported the highest number of positive test results for being the most affected. And in this group, Abbott is correct. Texas has the second lowest death rate. Only Tennessee has a lower death rate. I also looked at the 25 states that have reported the most fatalities from the coronavirus,
right.
And there Texas has the lowest death rate. So this was an easy claim.
All right, let's get to a ruling then.
We rated it true.
True. Let's go on to the next and third claim here. Only about 10% or even less of Texans who test positive for COVID-19 ever even need to go to the hospital in the first place. What did you do to verify this one?
So this claim is a little bit tricky. We don't actually have the data that will allow us to calculate what percentage of all coronavirus cases we've ever had have resulted in hospitalizations since the start of the pandemic, because the state doesn't actually track cumulative hospitalization figures. They only have a number every day of how many people are currently in the hospital. But what we can calculate is the hospitalization rate for the virus on a given day by looking at the number of active infections compared to the current hospitalization figure. Okay. And the number of active infections is an estimate that the state produces based on hospitalization times and recoveries. And at the time of Abbott's remark, there were about 30,000 active coronavirus infections and about 2,500 people in the hospital. So that's about 8.3% of active cases where the individual ended up in the hospital. And this figure has fluctuated. If we look back through the available state figures, on some days it's as high as 16%, and on other days it's as low as 5%.
So a ruling here.
We rated this claim mostly true. Abbott's figure's in the ballpark, but we've seen these numbers fluctuate.
Well, there you have it. Mixed results from Governor Abbott's COVID-19 press conference last week. Those rulings from Madeline Meckelberg at PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American-Statesman. Madeline, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening
to the Texas Standard.
Eric Austin, managing editor over at KERA News in North Texas. He's monitoring the talk of Texas in lieu of Wells Dunbar. What are you seeing out there, Eric?
Hey, David. A lot of chatter about your interview earlier in the show with Dr. Peter Hotez about the rise in COVID cases. He told you we have got to do more than put on face masks, and every passing day it gets harder and harder to put this back in the bottle. And Matt Adkins on Twitter is saying, if only we did not have people who still think this is a hoax. Wake up, Texas. So lots of people interested in that conversation. We will share it later. It'll be at texasstandard.org for those of you who aren't familiar with our site. Now, something I found online, David, that I want to share with you and our friends across Texas, it is related to COVID. COVID is stressing us out, and we have Twitter proof. An analysis of Twitter data reveals that the Dallas suburb of Plano, of all the cities, is the second most stressed city in the U.S. when it comes to COVID. They're stressing out, David. This, according to Babylon Health, gathered 2.5 million tweets over a two-week period in May. And David, I thought my job sifting through all the Texas tweets was tough enough, but they went through 2.5 million tweets and looking for terms like self-isolation, coronavirus, and social distancing.
Yeah,
41% of the tweets relating to the coronavirus in Plano were tagged or measured as stressed. So Plano topping the state, the number one ranking though nationwide, goes to Stockton, California, which just edged up Plano by a bit.
You know, so, I wonder about the methodology here. I'll be totally honest with you. I mean, a lot of people have said that Twitter is not necessarily indicative of the public's attitudes at large about any number of things. So who knows? But it's an interesting claim.
That is so true. Take it with many, many grains of salt, you know. But Babylon Health is behind that. So if you want to search them and find their methodology. And
all right.
Moving from COVID to something else, buzzy online. Do you hear that buzzing sound, David?
I do, from you.
The
yes.
sound of mosquitoes. It's Mosquito Awareness Week.
Right.
Texas A&M AgriLife, as if we need more stuff to worry about. Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service sent out an alert. Did you know there are 85 species of mosquitoes in Texas?
one is enough for me, frankly. But yeah, 85 is pretty scary. That's pretty frightening.
I know. And there are some that feed during the day, and there are some that feed at night. So if you're wondering why we see all these mosquitoes, it's like two feeding cycles. Can you imagine? I mean, for those of you going outside right now, you know, wear your mask and be careful, according to the public health experts, but also be aware, be on the lookout for those mosquitoes.
Yeah. Amen to that. Sometimes I feel like they're all feeding on me. Maybe that's just a personal perspective there. Hey, listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but as Eric says, the news continues over at texasstandard.org. We're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you will join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, wishing you a terrific Wednesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.